If you took Gerhardus Voss's understanding of redemptive history, he would tell you that the canon begins with creation perfection. And we don't often put the word perfection with the word creation, do we? See, but when heaven and earth, the plants, the land, animals, and man came from the hand of God, everything was perfect. Now there's something we can learn right away. Perfection does not mean an unchanging, static state. Perfection still leaves room for change and development. God planted a garden, you remember? Perfect garden. And what did he say to man? Dress it and keep it. Put your mark on it. Develop it. The second is fallen judgment. It starts at Genesis 3, and we'll look at that in detail. As soon as sin comes, all special revelation becomes redemptive in its orientation, and we move into redemption and grace, all the way from the Protevangelium of Genesis 3:15 right up to the consummation. And then, of course, the Bible ends with the consummation and restoration in the book of Revelation. There's a sense in which the Bible begins in a garden planted by God in the land called Eden. In that garden, God placed his image in order for his image to transcribe his glory in the world. Sin came and disrupted everything. The last Adam came and reversed the consequences of the first Adam's sin. When the last Adam returns in victory, and we have new heaven and new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness, we're going to end Revelation 22 in a garden again. Starts in a garden, it ends in a garden. They're kind of the bookmarks that put the whole of Scripture together. So I'm very interested that we talk a little bit, at least, about the nature of creation and how culture was to be developed from God's perspective. The earth was designed to be a perfect environment so that man, as God's image and likeness, could function wholly. He was the crown of creation. They were to have rest, have dominion, live in peace with each other and with God, and become involved in God's purpose in his world. I think you have to understand that in Genesis 1 and 2, the creation itself is characterized by shalom, peace, no barriers. No barriers between the man and his wife. No barriers between man and the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom. No barriers between man and God. And that's basically how I would define peace. Now we read in Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without boundaries, and it was empty, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Ruach Elohim, the Spirit of God, hovered over the waters. And God said, let there be light. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what we have then in Genesis 1 are the first three boundaries that are introduced. Light and darkness now become a consistent boundary. He says, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters to divide the waters from the waters. So we have waters above the sky and waters underneath. Okay? He says, let the dry land appear. And then he says, let the earth bring forth plants, herbs, and fruit trees. Please note, on day three, there is more than one creative fiat. It includes the appearance of dry land, and it includes the vegetable kingdom. Now he begins to fill it. He fills the skies with the luminaries. He fills the sea with sea life and the open atmosphere with birds. And then on day six again, we have two creative theists. All the land animals are created, and then man is created. Therefore, the emphasis in Genesis chapter 1 is on day 3 and day 6. And the special emphasis on day 6 falls upon this very unique being called man, the image of God. If we're going to understand man's place in culture, it's important for us to grasp this at the beginning. What did God form Adam from? What did God speak to when he created the plant kingdom? Let the earth bring forth. What did he speak to when he created the animal kingdom? Let the earth bring forth. Right? Notice how important that concept of earth is in this creation. Adam is formed from the dirt of the ground. The grass, trees, and herbs are the product of God speaking to the earth, and the land animals are the product of God speaking to the earth. You see, although man was to rule, man had a stake in the earth. What was he made of? Dirt. That's terrible, isn't it? You know, dirt you are, and to dirt you will return. But so you get to see then that when we talk about the development of culture, that man has a place in relationship to the earth from which he was formed. Breath of life. Genesis 2:7 says, God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became an animated creature. The birds have the breath of life. The land animals have the breath of life. So man shares breath of life with multiple aspects of creation, shares the earth with the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom, and he shares animate life. Adam is a living creature. Sea life is called living creatures. Birds are called living creatures, and all the land animals are called living creatures. But what makes man distinct is that man and man alone is the image of God. Calvin said it this way, and it's beautiful. He says, the proper study of man begins with the study of God, because man is in the image of God. You can't understand man if you don't understand God. So that whole concept of image I want to spend a few moments with. Only man is called image. There are two words that are used there in Hebrew, tselem and demut. I take them to be synonyms, and we'll look at what their implications are. The text is fascinating. And God said, let us make man in our image. The summary statement comes, in the image of God created he him. And the third parallel comes, male and female created he them. Now we don't often contemplate the significance of that. God created his image a unity with a difference. The unity is image. The difference is male, female. We're going to have image male, image female. They are both equally image. So this unity with a difference is going to have a great deal to do with the development of culture. And we'll see that in just a few minutes. Let me share with you my understanding of the concept of imago or image. Man has an antecedent to his being. Man is a kind of a copy being. There are no eternal elephants of which earth elephants are copies. Is that true? All elephants are created. There is only one being who has an antecedent to his being, and that's man. And the antecedent to man's being is the being of God, because man is created in the image of God. It is image that distinguishes man from the animals. Third, man is created to live in three irreducible life relationships. May I ask you, does God live in relationships? Are there three persons? Are they of equal value? Do they share a common essence? Do they have a mutual love for each other? Therefore, we're not surprised that when man is created in the image of God, man is created to live in relationships. He's created to live in relationship to God. He's created to live in a unique relationship with another fellow image in what we call marriage. And he is created in relationship to the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, and the earth. So that when we contemplate that, then we come to realize that this idea of image is very broad. It also involves certain capacities. Man speaks at his level of existence because antecedently God speaks. Man thinks at his level of existence and he reasons because God speaks and reasons at his level of existence. And man is a creaturely copy of what God is like. Man is created to be God's vice regent to develop and to rule the earth. See, the production of culture is at the heart of the purpose for which God created man. God at his level of existence rules. Man is created in the image of God. And therefore man at his level of existence is created to rule. There is a moral dimension to image. God is impeccably holy. He is free from sin. Man created in his image was not created a sinful creature. He was created creaturely righteous. He was righteous in this sense. He was rightly related to God. He was rightly related to the woman. And he was rightly related to the earth, the plant kingdom, and the vegetable kingdom. Righteousness was a gift of God to the creature at creation. There is such a thing as creational righteousness that precedes redemptive righteousness. The whole man is the whole image. Now, with that kind of concept in mind, then let's talk about aspects of it as it relates to culture. He's created rightly related to God. He would sustain that relationship by constantly rendering obedience to every divine command. He was created rightly related to Isha, woman. This was a relationship of coordination. There was no barrier between them. We know that because the text says they were both naked and they knew no shame. He was created rightly related to the plant kingdom, to the animal kingdom, and to the earth. And it was over the plants and the animals that he was to reign on God's behalf. It was not over fellow image. God did not create his image to rule each other. He created his image to rule the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, and the earth, and to develop all of the potency of that for the glory of God. For that, he gave him some wonderful capacities. the ability to use symbols and rules, and thus to produce speech. Again, to use symbols and rules, and thus do logic. He created him with a volition, the ability to make choices. He created him with an aspect of his being that had high appreciation for beauty and for everything that belonged to the beautiful. This is an aspect of the capacities that we spend very little time with in the day and age in which we live. But God gave man a task. He said to man, have dominion. This verb, radah, okay, it doesn't mean rape the earth to your own advantage. Radah is a word of kingly stewardship. Radah means to render a kingly stewardship by developing and expressing and manifesting the glory of God in the framework of creation. So his task under God was indeed a stewardship of the glory of God that had not yet fully been developed in the creation in which he was a part. Remember, he's related to the earth. He's related to the animal kingdom. You should be able to remember that one. But he's also related to all creatures with the breath of life. So when we contemplate that, then we realize what this dominion means. It means royal stewardship. It means a vice regency of accountability. The second word that is used is a stronger word, kabash. He says, have dominion and subdue. When we think of subdue, we think of something resisting us that we have to overcome. Well, there was nothing in creation that would resist man. There was nothing there that was recalcitrant. It wasn't as if Satan was the prince of the power of the air and now man has to fight to subdue. It all would be subject to his direction. One of the meanings in the semantic range of this Hebrew verb is the word to knead. You know how you knead bread? No. Before bread machines. Before we got into this lazy mode of life. Well, the word means to put together in combination and to do it in such a way that it produces something that is different than any of the component parts. That's what man is to do. He is to have royal dominion, and he has to put together the created order in ways that none of the present parts are put together. And in doing that, he will develop and express the glory of God within the framework of culture. When it comes to his place in the garden, God says to him, he is to, excuse me, he is to serve the garden. That's that first verb there, abad. It's an interesting word. In the Latin Vulgate, abad is translated with the Latin word cultura, from which we get our word culture. Here's where the word comes from, historically. Okay? He is to serve. He is to serve the garden by developing all of its potency, by taking it into the prism of his self-consciousness, by rearranging the plantings, by whatever means possible to extend the glory of God in the earth. The second word over here, shamar, kind of a shock that you read dress and keep. The word keep means guard. It's almost as if God in advance said to Adam, you're going to have to be vigilant because at some point you may face the need of guarding the garden from wrong forces or powers. Now, to know how he did that, I'm not sure. But here's the mandate. We often call this the creation mandate or the cultural mandate. Okay? If I had planted a perfect garden, you know what I would have said to Adam? Stay off the grass and don't pick the flowers. Okay? God said to Adam, Adam, you put your mark on this garden. You transplant the materials. You put them into relationships that aren't here. You develop their capacity. You pick the flowers. And you put them in a vase. And you put different shapes of flowers together with assorted colors. And with that aesthetic quality, which the bouquet brings, that doesn't exist out there because that's not how they grow, you will extend my glory in the world. It's an amazing task, the cultural task. Okay? God created that first environment as a kind of nest where there was peace and rest and harmony. The nest was to be developed by man. Thus, man has a two-directional office. In relationship to God, he is to be God's obedient servant. That is, he is to render obedience to every divine command. Dress and keep the garden are commands. Have dominion is a command. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother is a command. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth is a command. God gave man a series of commands, even in advance of sin, for the direction of his life. But he's also God's steward. He is to render a faithful stewardship of what has been committed to his hand to rule over, to keep, and to dress, or to serve. So that's the place of man. That's what God intended to take place. Now when we come to this and we look at this, especially in the garden, you know, we come to some amazing material. Right? The first thing we learn is that after God has said everything is good over and over and over through Genesis 1, in Genesis 2 he says, it is not good that man should be alone. Therefore, I will make a help suitable to him. And Yahweh God caused a deep sleep to come upon the man, and he took bone and flesh, and from it he built the woman, and he brought the woman to the man, and the man said, she is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called Isha, because she was taken out of Ish. What a wonderful name, right? Ish is one of the names for man. Isha means out of Ish. Well, you can't help when you read the account of the creation of the woman that the intent of this is community and companionship. I've done so much premarital counseling in my life as a college professor and at the seminary, and it always amazes me how couples will come to the possibility of marriage, each having their own agenda, and they're going to kind of live under the same roof together, but they kind of go their own way. It's not God's intent for marriage at all. He intends community and companionship. Amen. If your wife is not your best friend, you've got a problem. And the problem is probably you. In other words, companionship is at the heart of this. She is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. There's an immediate attraction. Wouldn't it work for him to say, you know, God, she's a knockout, but I think I'll look around. There wasn't anywhere to look. Okay. But she is out of him. And the attraction, is to bring them together. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and be glued unto his wife. This is a grabbing hold and holding close. This is something that is almost totally essential to understand the nature of this. There's to be cherishing. This is a relationship that is going to be one of the aspects of the three things that God created man for. And in the midst of that, he intended all of it to produce an intimacy. No barriers. No deceit. Can't imagine marriage that way, can you? No barriers, no conflict, no deceit. And this is told to us in a wonderful little phrase that they were both naked and they knew no shame. It simply means that there wasn't any guilt, there wasn't any breach of peace. They lived together in harmony, they held each other close, they cherished each other, the attraction was strong, they were going to be companions under God to fulfill what God had commanded. What a wonderful vision for marriage. May I say to you, without marriage and procreation, the glory of God couldn't fill the earth. Because what is man? He's the image of God. And what does he have to have dominion over? Everything. Now I understand why it was essential that they procreate. Well, chapter 3, we are brought into contact with the dynamics of the fall. We read in chapter 3, now the serpent was more crafty than any of the beasts of the field. So that when we start in Genesis 3, we start with an attempt by Satan to bring deception to the image of God. Isn't it interesting that Satan chose to attack the image of God in the relationship of husband-wife, not the relationship of creature-God or image-earth, plants or animals? In the intimacy of the relationship of husband-wife, apparently the serpent thought that to be the vulnerable place with deception to bring the pressure to bear to destroy the rest and the peace that characterized creation. You would have every right to ask the question, when did Satan and the angels who followed him fall from heaven? And I would have to tell you that exegetically, I don't know any place I can turn you to in the Bible that will answer that question. I can tell you that in terms of the application of logic to the question, it happened sometime after the sixth day and before the testing of the woman in the garden. Because I don't believe Satan was the prince of the power of the air when man was placed in the garden. So something happened. the vulnerability of this relationship is going to be tested. That deception led to doubt. The woman was not able to detect the voice of the tempter in the speech of the serpent. The doubt came with a question. Yea, if God said you can't eat of the trees of the garden? And she said, no, that's not what he said. He said, we can eat of the trees of the garden, but the tree in the middle of the garden, we're not to appropriate it. But he's trying to get her to doubt the fullness of God's provision and suggesting to her that God is holding back something that is to their great benefit. God knows the day you eat thereof, your eyes will be opened, you'll be more like God, and you will know good and evil. So the doubt comes. When you put deception and doubt together into a larger flow, it leads to desire. The text says, she looked at the fruit and she saw that it was aesthetically beautiful. Now, lots of artists find fruit aesthetically beautiful and paint it very, very well. Now, through the doubt song, she looks, and this piece of fruit in all of its beauty now looks like something worth having, something worth coveting, something worth taking. Not only that, as she continues to look at it, she says it's desirable because it'll make us wise. We'll be more like God. We'll know good and evil. Deception plus doubt plus desire. And notice the arrows get thicker because the next step includes the previous steps, leads to disobedience. She took the fruit and she ate it and she gave it to her husband who was with her. Now you put those four together and those four lead to shame. Please understand what that means. That means a wall has gone up between husband and wife, between image and God, between man and the created order. So don't just read over that and not grasp it. And then the consequences of shame, it's utterly amazing. They hear the voice of Christ in the garden in the breeze of the day. And they're afraid. Up till now, there's been no fear, has there? Notice what's happening to peace and rest. Notice what's transpiring in culture. And then look what happens. They make coverings out of leaves. They hide under the tree. And they blame each other and the serpent. Does that sound familiar to you? I mean, this seems like what life is like, isn't it? May I say something? Genesis 3 is a historical statement of the fall of man, but it's archetypal. It is the same kinds of things that Satan uses on us today. We're forever not wanting people to know. We're forever hiding, unwilling to be transparent. We hide the walls in our marriages so other people don't see it, but there is real in the conflict. Find the same with children, in the parent-child relationship, in all of these things. I mean, this is a model from Genesis 3 that is almost perpetuated day in and day out within the framework of Scripture. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know, I didn't know what word to use to bring this to its consummation. So I used one that's probably not biblical, and if you have a better one, I'd love to hear it. Looks like life turned into a scramble. You know what your life seems like? One constant, habitual scramble. Do you understand what Jesus meant in Matthew 11 when he said, "Come unto me, all you who are double burdened and fatigued, and I will give you what? Rest." Rest is what was lost in the garden. Rest is what is restored in the last Adam. Now you have to understand, rest doesn't mean constant napping, carrying a camera like a tourist. Rest means no barriers. Means no impediment to relationships. Between us and God, between us and our wives and our children, between us and the community, the redeemed. Two things are cursed: the ground and the serpent. The very earth over which man was to have dominion is now going to resist it. It's not going to yield its strength. It's going to produce things that are inedible. Therefore, to get a food source out of it, you're going to have to rip it open with a plow. You're going to have to take care of the weeds. You may have to develop some chemicals, all of which will be detrimental to your health, in order to get more out of it, because your ultimate aim is profit. I mean, where did all of this come from? Woman is going to have increased pain, increased conceptions. Her desire is going to be to her husband. The serpent is going to go on its belly. Man, woman, the animals, all are now subject to death. Up to then there had been no death. And then some of the saddest things you ever read: God drove them from the garden and from the tree of life, and there he set the terrible fighters and the flaming sword. Well, there's the first culture and the cultural mandate. There's the demise of the first culture. Okay? And now we're going to watch culture develop in a much different paradigm. We're going to come to the time period known as redemption and grace. From the fall to the flood, we have two lines develop: the line of Cain and the line of Seth. Here's the line of Cain. And here's the line of Seth. I know I'm weird, but I like genealogies. This genealogy tells us a lot. Please notice, in the line of Cain, Cain slew his brother Abel, and his brother's blood cried out from the ground. And God judged Cain, said, "You're going to be a fugitive and a vagabond, and you're going to stray about all over the earth. You're going to have no peace and no rest." And Cain said, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." Somehow, either a sister or a niece, because Adam had many sons and daughters, cast her lot with Cain. And Cain left the east of the garden and set out on his own. And with his wife, she got pregnant and had a baby. I don't know about you, but if I was God, Cain would have been sterile. I would not have allowed this line to procreate. You can be grateful I'm not God, believe me. Please notice the name of the son. You know another one over here, don't you? Enoch, the seventh from Adam, he walked with God and he was not, for God took him. Here's Enoch, the son of Cain. Guess what Cain was doing before his son was born? He was building a city. Here's the origin of man's city. Here's the beginning of man making over culture to suit himself while raising a fist of rebellion to the Creator. He called the name of the city Enoch, and he called the name of his son Enoch. God said, you're going to be a fugitive and stray about. You know what Cain said? I don't need you for peace and security. I'll have peace and security on my own. I'll build a city. There I'll find peace and security. Get the irony of that. Do you feel secure and peaceful in men's cities today? It's an amazing irony if you contemplate it. Here we have a culture developing, and it's going to be dominated by this line. Please realize that although they reject God, they don't stop from putting L on the end of names, and that L, well, I didn't know that that did that, but let's not play with this thing. That L itself is the shortened form for God. Mahujael, Mahushael, from Elohim. And then Lamech comes. And Lamech is the first known to breach the marriage ordinance. He took two wives. And Lamech, the father of Jabal, Jubal, and Tubal-Cain, he had three boys who were inventive geniuses. Jabal and Jubal, one invented music, hollowed out a reed, put holes in it, blew through it, and by varying the holes, was able to get pitch and vary it, took some gut and made a stringed instrument. Here we have the origin of music in rebellion against God, coming from the line of Cain. I want you to know we've baptized far too much Canaanite music into our churches and into our lives. Anybody who doesn't think that the culture makes its inroad into your life through music makes an enormous mistake. That's why iPods and all the other things are such effective ways to communicate culture and rebellion against God, generation after generation. The second one invents the tent. The first RV. Right? Going to make life easier for the nomadic straying about with the herds, because what's happened to the earth? It's producing inedible things. Going to have to keep moving. So we have the city. We have portable domiciles. We now have music to ease what's going on. Death is present. Then we come to Tubal-Cain. Tubal-Cain learned how to take ore out of the ground and smelt it and to forge it into useful implements. No doubt forged it into implements of tyranny. Because his father, Lamech, with, in my judgment, two swords made by Tubal-Cain, gives us this obnoxious statement. Zeta and Zilpah, listen to me. I have killed a man for wounding me. If God will be avenged sevenfold, Lamech will be avenged 70 times seven. This arrogant bigamist said, I am stronger than God. You come over here to the line of Set. Set means substitute. You notice again the E-L at the end of the names. You notice Lamech, the parallel. Seven generations, threefold breakdown. 10 generations, threefold breakdown. Lamech names his son Noah, for he says this: God is going to give us rest concerning the ground which he hath cursed. Noah's name means rest. It's an amazing predictive statement. He has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The entire culture post-Eden is now being developed. When you get to Genesis 6, you learn that this culture became dominated by violence. The whole earth was full of violence. God repented that he ever made man. There were killers in the earth, pre-flood mafia types. You couldn't go anywhere and be safe. You couldn't be in the World Trade Center or the tubes of London. Violence was everywhere. It was so bad that those terrible words, God repented that he ever made man. Well, the flood comes. Now we're going to find that the fall, followed by the flood to the Tower of Babel, brings us some very interesting things. How many humans survived the flood? Eight. Four pair. What animals were placed in the ark? Three pair plus one of all of the clean animals, and one pair of unclean animals. No aquarium in the ark. Sea life would have to survive in the water. Not every kind of plant seed was preserved. In fact, there was no gathering of all the created kinds of plants. So what we find happening is that post-flood, we have the eight couples, and from them we have a new beginning. This new beginning is one that's going to affect, again, the development of culture. You remember Noah got drunk, and in his nakedness, his son Ham went into the tent and gazed on his father's nakedness. He came out and told Shem and Japheth, and they walked in backwards with a cover and covered the nakedness of their father. And when Noah awoke, prophetically, he spoke some words of judgment as well as words of blessing. In Ham, somehow gazing at the naked genitals of his father was pleasing to him. And we get the first inclination in the biblical content of any kind of concept of homosexuality. The judgment is placed on him. No. The judgment is placed on who? Canaan. Canaan was one of the four sons of Ham. Is that correct? Who inhabited Palestine? Who inhabited Sodom and Gomorrah? Canaanites. Did God bring judgment when the iniquity of the Canaanites was full? So we pick up right away in the post-flood time period that there are going to be some difficulties to work with. But the first thing we learn is that soon after the flood, man's back at building cities. And this is a beautiful thing to see. The whole earth was of one language. Okay? And they wanted to build. So they encouraged each other, said, let's make brick, let's use bitumen for our binding power. Let's build us a city and a tower, and this tower will rise up to heaven. Then God responds, the Lord came down. This is beautiful in Hebrew. Where is the tower supposed to reach? Lord says, I don't see it. Let us go down. Notice how it matches. Let us go down and see the city and the tower. Each step in has a parallel step out, which man has built. Come, let us mix up their understanding. Come, let us make bricks. Come, let us mix up their understanding. They will not be able to understand each other's language. From there, they were scattered abroad. The language of the whole earth now becomes multilinguistic, and here, ladies and gentlemen, is the beginning of pluriform or multicultures. Because here, based on language, people were forced to divide. And this, when I first say it to you, may not sound very profound, but if you contemplate it, you may catch it, and that is this. Language is the basis for culture. You cannot know a culture if you don't know its language. It's language is the vehicle. And it comes in many, many different kinds of forms. Well, can't spend that much time with all of these. We'll be here all day just doing the biblical material. After the flood, God breaks into history and calls a man by the name of Abram. He's an idol worshiper on the other side of the river. Right? He was a really great guy, you know. He was just hiding there waiting for God to come and talk to him. No. He was in rebellion against God. He was on the other side of the river. He lived for idolatry, and God broke sovereignly into his life and called him. And that call brought about a covenant with Abraham that all the nations of the earth would be blessed in him. Jacob, all of Israel ended up in Egypt. As a consequence, they had to be redeemed. And the Old Testament redemptive event is that they are released by power and by blood out of their bondage in Egypt and freed to move toward the promised land. After they get into the promised land, after all of the drudgery of 40 years in the wilderness, they are unwilling to walk with fidelity with their God. The northern kingdom goes into captivity to Assyria. The southern kingdom goes into captivity to the Babylonians. They're taken in exile. The land is empty. They're allowed to return, but nothing like it used to be. Then all of a sudden, God begins to act in history again, and the Spirit. Darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God, the Ruach Elohim, hovered over the waters. Luke, Angel Gabriel comes to a young girl, Mary. Says, Mary, the Lord is with you, and Mary, you're going to have a child, and what is born of you will be the Holy Son of God. She says, how can these things be? I have never known a man. In the past, we had women past the ability to bear children. Think of Sarah. We had barren women bear children. Think of Hannah. But now we have a virgin. A young girl, probably 15. And she asks, how can it be? And listen to the answer. The power of the Most High will overshadow you. This word overshadow in Greek is closely related to the word hover back in Genesis. If you don't put Genesis 3 and Luke 1 together, you miss a great deal. Here comes the Ruach Elohim. In the darkness of the womb of Mary and of the stuff of Mary's body, he's going to form the perfect manhood of Christ and preserve it from the taint of sin. The Holy Spirit is going to come upon you and he is going to overshadow you. At his baptism, while he's in the water, who comes down in dove-like fashion and alights on him? The Holy Spirit. Who drives him to the wilderness to be tempted? The first man faced all the onslaughts of Satan in a perfect garden prepared by God with absolutely no impediments or no difficulties. The last Adam is going to face the same tempter in the haunt of demons, the wilderness, the place the world has come because of man's sin. Amazing. Did he pass the test? Did he love God with all of his heart, soul, strength, and might? Command the stones be made bread. Cast yourself down. God hath given the angels charge over you. Bow down and worship me, and I will give you the kingdoms. You don't have to walk the path of deprivation. You don't have to put up with the hunger. You can jump from this pinnacle and still live and be freed from the duress that you're under. You can eat if you wish. If you'll only bow to me, I will make you wealthy. I will give you all of the kingdoms. And how does it end? Get away from me, Satan. Bless God for the last Adam. Okay. His ministry, death, resurrection, and ascension. His enthronement in heaven. Okay. All of this relates to the atonement, whereby he has reversed the consequences of Adam's sin. And the reversal of these consequences are going to enable God to have a people that will be distinct, a people who will do culture much differently than the people who live in rebellion against him. On the day of Pentecost, the age of the Spirit is inaugurated. The church is brought together as a baptized body of believers. They're given a task and a mission. What was Adam's task? Adam's task was a non-redemptive stewardship of creation. What is the task of the new people of God, the progeny of the last Adam? Why, they have a redemptive stewardship of the earth, so that every tribe, kindred, tongue, and people are going to hear. Consummation. Right now, everything's groaning. It's groaning in San Lorenzo today, again, with rain. Right? The whole creation is groaning. It's waiting to be released from the bondage of corruption. We ourselves are groaning, even though we have the first fruits of the Spirit. Christ is going to bring the fullness of his atonement to bear. And there's going to be consummation and restoration plus. There'll be new heaven and new earth. We will finally get to a place where there's no more scramble, no deception, no doubt, no desire, no disobedience, no shame, no fear. The Lord will be with us on the new earth. And we will rule and reign with him forever as the last Adam. There'll be no more war. everything will be shalom and there will be rest. Well, how are we doing for time? Let me just give you definitions and we'll quit for this session. Here are some attempts to define culture. The sum total of the ways of living. Human communities build them up and transmit them from generation to generation. Any or all human effort expended on the cosmos to unearth its treasures and to use them and to pass them on to the future generation. Includes all of man's work, his art, science, literature, language, astronomy, his rites of worship, his domestic life, his social customs, his political structure. These are all the things that man produces. They either stand in the service of Christ and the kingdom, or they stand in service to idols. Culture is notoriously difficult to define. We'll start our next session by looking at what I think is an adequate, at least an initial adequate, theological definition. But for right now, we'll quit and try to do some questions and answers.